In the campaign for U.S. Senate, Republican Mike Round says voters have a very clear choice between philosophies on how government should run and which direction the nation should head in the future. Mike Round served in the state legislature before first being elected governor in 2002, and following his second term in office, he returned to his insurance and real estate business. He faces Democrat Rick Wyland and Independents Larry Pressler and Gordon Howey in the November 4th election to fill the seat being vacated by retiring U.S. Senator Tim Johnson. He joins us in the studio. And Mike Rounds, thanks for joining us on Dakota Midday.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to visit with you and have a cup of coffee at the same time.
Busy morning so far?
Very busy morning, but that's kind of the way it is. My wife says it's just all self-inflicted. So away we go with it. We know what we're getting into, and I think it's for the right reasons. Citizens need to have the opportunity to look at multiple options, and when it comes to activities going on in Washington, D.C., I think most of the people in South Dakota are pretty fed up with what's going up there. They're tired of the bickering. They're tired of the fighting. They're tired of no results. They take a look at a budget that hasn't been passed in 5 years, and they say, why can't they do the stuff we do in South Dakota where we live within our means? And I call it South Dakota common sense. So I'm getting into the middle of it because I think we got to fix some stuff up there, and I think we go on in and you don't sit back and relax. You get in there and you get the stuff done, and I think governors can do that. A good example is what's going on with the Ebola issues right now. You've got a federal government that clearly is being indecisive. They've made some serious issues that have been brought to the forefront of the people of this country where they're concerned about what the actual impacts are of Ebola, how serious it's going to be in the United States, whether or not we're doing the right thing and getting it contained in Africa, whether or not having a travel ban is the right thing to do, and even on what they're trying to do in terms of the hospitals and so forth that are supposed to be in a position to take care of someone that does have Ebola and to limit it. Now we're finding out that maybe some of the protocols aren't exactly the way that they thought they were. And when you get that kind of concern going on, it comes back down to whether or not you got a strategic plan, whether or not you got the professionals in the right spot to get the deal done, and whether or not politicians are allowing those professionals to get it done with the necessary resources. So once again, we're right in the middle of concerns, and it's that kind of frustration that really drives me to get back in actively within the political process.
Now, that frustration with Washington is a common theme of probably everyone that's running for Congress, and even your opponent, Rick Wyland, uses the slogan, taking it back. And on your website, you talk about taking government back as well. What is the difference there? You know, he has a different idea of taking it back than you. What is the difference there?
You know, I think the best example is at the state fair debate where Rick said, look, big government's not the problem. And I had to think twice and say, did Rick really say that? And the answer is big government is the problem. And a great example of it's what's going on right now. Obamacare is put in place by a group of people in the House and the Senate that never read the bill in the first place. They hand it back over to a group of bureaucrats who they then expect to write literally thousands of pages of rules that the rest of America's got to live with. And we haven't read all the thousands of pages yet, and yet we know that there's new taxes involved in it. We know that they've actually are impacting Medicare. Section 3403 of that particular act creates an independent payment advisory board. And what do? They're looking at limiting the payments to doctors who are providing assistance to Medicare recipients. You take a look at the thousands of pages and you realize the bureaucrats are really writing the rules in this country. Let's take a look at the Environmental Protection Agency and what they're up to right now. So far, they've tried to put together a plan in which they could regulate farm dust. And then when they got laughed at, then they said, well, but you know, carbon dioxide is a problem in America today too. And you know, livestock pass a lot of gas. And so now they're looking at whether or not they can regulate livestock and whether when they pass gas. I mean, this is, and now the same organization, which is filled with bureaucrats who have probably never been on a farm, now these same folks are coming back in and saying, well, Congress is expecting that we should also be creating a new energy policy that makes the American consumer use less energy that is carbon-based because we don't want carbon dioxide in the atmosphere because it'll increase climate change. And so now they've got a new proposal, which has already been published, and they're asking for comments on whether or not their energy proposal that will tax our energy that we need every single day in our homes to the tune, now get this, their current proposal, according to the United States Chamber of Commerce, will cost the average American family $140 more per month on their utility bill. And you say, well, Congress didn't do that. They didn't. The problem is they gave too doggone much power to a federal bureaucracy, to a federal agency that now is deciding they can publish these rules. And by the way, Congress doesn't have a say as to whether or not they get accepted or not. They go into effect, and the same people that wrote the rules at the EPA that are now taking comments from literally thousands, if not millions of people about how crazy these new proposals are, get to decide whether or not their original proposal was a good idea or not. This has got to stop. It's one of the reasons, and you know, we complain about it, and here's what we ought to do about it. There's a bill. It's called the RAINS Act. It passed the House of Representatives. It's been languishing in the United States Senate. Harry Reid is never going to bring it up, and because of that, it'll never get passed until Republicans take back the United States Senate. If they fire Harry Reid, bring in another leader, this will get put for a vote. And if it's put for a vote, it might very well pass. And what it says is that no more of these huge new rules can be put on the backs of the American public unless Congress has the guts to vote for that rule after it's been proposed. In other words, the American public can come back and point their finger at their elected person and say, why did you do this tax increase to us? And Congress will have no excuse for saying, well, it's just a federal agency doing that, and we're really going to fight bureaucracy. Now you put the onus back on the elected officials in this country. And I think the sooner we get that done, the better. Did you know that there are a million rules that have been promulgated and put in effect on the American public by bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. When you think about this, this unelected group of people, they think, or at least they appear to think, that we work for them instead of the other way around. There's no recourse. It's tough to fire them. And Congress has been sitting on their butts, not getting into the middle of this thing because they don't want to take the heat. It's time they start taking the heat, and it's time they start taking responsibility for all of these millions of regulations that have been passed, and it's time we get some of that freedom back out. Just because you're a member of Congress doesn't mean that you should be in everybody's classroom, and it doesn't mean that you should be making the local elected officials' decisions that should be made at a county officials' level, or at a city commission level, or at a state legislative level, just because you can. I tell them, look, if you want to impact local units of government, then run for the legislature, not Congress. If you want to talk about education and regulate what's going on in our classrooms and which courses are going to be taught and all that stuff, then run for the local school board. But let's focus Congress back on what they were supposed to be in the first place, which is the responsibility of the federal government, strong national defense, the defense of our borders. Let's focus on the big issues here. Let's actually pass a budget. Instead of going 5 years with getting one that's kind of deferred and moved along, let's do it on time so that businesses and citizens know in advance what the new rules are going to be and where the funding's going to go to. We expect that in South Dakota. Obamacare should be repealed and replaced. People in South Dakota agree on that. But I'm the candidate that's saying it. The other guys aren't. The Keystone XL pipeline's been languishing for 6 years. It should have been passed already. We should be pumping oil through pipelines rather than putting it on trains and taking the spots and congesting the rail lines so that we can't get our grains to market. That's going to be a major economic impact to the people of South Dakota. And I know I'm doing a monotone here, but this is the kind of stuff that's got to get fixed in Washington, D.C.
Now, you mentioned the EPA. What do you see the role of EPA in, you know, you mentioned the bureaucracy, some things that maybe don't need to be done, but how do you see the role of the EPA?
I blame Congress for the expansive role of the EPA, the unfettered role of the EPA. We all want clean water. We all want clean air. We don't want to have bad chemicals put into our systems. We want someone that literally takes a common sense approach and that works to make our environment better than what it was before, to keep it as clean and pristine as possible. But that doesn't mean that the EPA should be deciding for themselves what their job is. Congress should decide what their job is. We shouldn't destroy our national economy because you've got a group of folks that are absolutely convinced that the greatest threat to the American way of life is climate change. Let me give you an example. we've got huge reserves of coal. We've got lots of natural gas. We've got lots of petroleum products. The folks that seem to focus on climate change don't seem to realize the impact that they have on our national economy when they tell us that we shouldn't be burning the coal, but that rather we should ship it someplace else where they have fewer controls than we do. That coal is going to get burned. It's just a matter of whether we do it in the best possible and efficient manner, or if we send it to China or some other place where they do it based on what their government guidelines are. It's still going to come into the atmosphere on a worldwide basis. Petroleum products right now, they're saying we can't do the Keystone XL because it will increase climate change. Yeah, have you seen the most recent European study that the opponents to the Keystone XL pipeline point to? It's a European study in which they say that if you build the Keystone XL pipeline and allow us to move Canadian and North Dakota crude down to refineries, if you do that, it's going to increase climate change according to their study. And their logic is that oil coming down, if we get it there by a pipeline rather than on the rail, it will save the average consumer 6 cents a gallon on the finished product. And if they save 6 cents a gallon on the finished product, they'll burn more of it. But, you know, when I talk to farmers and ranchers that burn one heck of a lot of diesel, they're not going to, when it comes time to combining their field of corn, they're not going to run around the field a few more times because their diesel costs 6 cents less. It saves them money. It makes them more productive. There's more of a margin there. They become more competitive. We've got to become energy independent in North America. We should be doing everything we can to expand our ability to produce our oil and our coal. And by the way, some people say, well, some of that's going to go overseas. Yeah, it probably will. But every time we market something overseas, we become a stronger ally for those places. President Putin figured that out in Russia. He's supplying one-third of Northern Europe with natural gas right now, and because of it, they're afraid of him. They know that he can shut off the lines coming in, and so they're very, very careful. In doing so, he's picked up Crimea, and he's working on the Ukraine right now, and a lot of it has to do, he doesn't have to fire a shot. All he's got to do is just have the threat of energy, which is what we've been used to since 1970s when we allowed the Middle East to become literally a major player in our economic success or failure in the United States.
Now, you were just talking about overseas, some of the situations that are going on there. Right now, we've got the situation with the so-called Islamic State. And last month, the U.S. Senate voted to approve the president's proposal to arm and train the moderate Syrian rebels. There are airstrikes going on. As a member of Congress, you would be dealing with these issues. What is your position on how we should approach what's happening in Syria and Iraq?
I think there's a couple things. Number one, you have to deal with the immediate threat of ISIS. They are a big deal right now, and they are an immediate threat. They're an immediate threat in that part of the world, and they will have capabilities, if we do not stop them, of threatening our homeland. I'm convinced of that. But more than that, I worry about not having a strategic long-term plan as a country in which we recognize the major threats. Iran, a nuclear Iran, is right around the corner. And while we are dealing with ISIS and it seems as though the president is really focused on ISIS right now and now apparently on Ebola, we're running closer and closer to the timeline in which they want to have a deal done with Iran. Iran has been delaying and delaying and delaying in negotiating with us while they get closer and closer and closer to having their nuclear weapons prepared. We cannot allow a nuclear Iran. If you have a nuclear Iran, it will not be long before you have a nuclear Saudi Arabia. They will buy the weapons, perhaps from Pakistan or someplace else, but they cannot, living in that region, allow Iran to have nuclear weapons and them not. If you have a nuclear-armed Middle East, it isn't very long, and it won't take very long, before the possibilities of a World War III develop. This is a major strategic threat to the long-term security of the United States. ISIS is part of it, but we can't lose the big pictures involved. And what I worry about is that as we have these crises of the moment coming through, whether it be the fact that we weren't on top of ISIS when it was developing 2 years ago, and the fact that we've been negotiating away a very good stand, and we've been relaxing the restrictions on the business activities in Iran, in doing so, we find ourselves being backed up farther and farther and farther into a corner. At some point, when you're not negotiating and recognizing that Iran's only goal here is to delay this long enough to be in a position to create the nuclear weaponry, you have to realize that our tactics in this thing are not in support of a strategic plan that's been well developed. And my concern as a member of the United States Senate is that we have strategic plans that are followed, consistent with professionals and the best information we've got, that we have the capabilities in the military to do everything that has to be done, that we go back to the old theory of peace through strength, or as Teddy Roosevelt said, speak very, very softly, but carry a great big stick. When you do that, you don't have to get into battles all the way. And if economically you are very strong and you are a provider of energy to other parts of the world, you can do things besides simply threaten force. And then you don't have to speak loudly, and you don't have to draw the red lines in the sand like the president's found himself doing when it comes to chemical weapons in the Middle East. So I really think we've got to take the long approach on this thing. We have to respect the president's power. We have to respect the president, the office of the president, and his responsibility to present those strategic plans. And then we need to support them within the United States Senate. But we have to question them as well.
One of the issues that's been discussed quite a bit over the last couple of months in the Senate campaign is the federal EB-5 investment program. Just to kind of clear things up a little bit there, what was your role in the administration of the EB-5 program while you were governor?
Back in 2002 when we came in, we looked at all of the tools that were available to a governor who wanted to develop the economy in South Dakota. Remember, our big challenge is just keeping young people in South Dakota. In order to do that, you've got to have strong universities. You've got to have research opportunities. You've got to have jobs available for them when they get out. So we focus on how do we keep kids here? Well, you develop job opportunities. You develop your economy. Ag is a huge part of it. One of the tools, we have the Ready Fund. We've got SBA loans. One of the tools was the federal EB-5 a visa program, which was established in 1990. Bipartisan support, Republicans and Democrats alike. Heck, Tom Daschle voted for it. Larry Pressler voted for it. Rick Weiland was one of the senior staff members on Tom Daschle's staff when they actually passed it. This program has never been partisan in nature until now when I ran for the United States Senate. The program says someone from overseas, if you come into the United States through this program, there's offices throughout the United States, 48 states have them. There's 500 of these offices that are out marketing, trying to find a way to bring these dollars into the United States. We have one. When I first became governor, it was attached to Northern State University through the Board of Regents, and it was called the International Business Institute. And one of their projects was having permission from the federal government to market EB-5 investments. So they told us, look, we can do this for dairies to begin with. Well, Brookings had been identified as the epicenter of where in North America where you could do great dairies. We had the Valley Queen cheese facilities up in Milbank. We had Davisco, which was developing, wanted to come in and develop north of Brookings. And Bell Brands just started their new, you see them, the little red tubes.
Baby Bell.
Yeah, Baby Bell cheeses. 25% of all of their product right now comes from EB-5 sponsored dairies in South Dakota. So the EB-5 program was designed by Congress to promote economic development in rural areas. The money would come from investors from other parts of the country, or other parts of the world. Canada did the same thing. But these investors could get a green card, no citizenship, but a green card to allow them to come with their immediate family into the United States if they invested $500,000 in a project which was at risk. In other words, they could not put it into a guaranteed program. If they put that money into an at-risk project and they developed jobs, they could get a green card if they passed the security rules. We looked at it and said, that's a great tool. It's one that we'd like to see utilized. We did, and for several years, we marketed for dairies, and we wanted more dairies in so we had enough milk to provide for the facilities up there so that we had a good, strong ag economy there based on dairy. Along the way, the feds changed the rules a little bit and said, you know what, you can not only do dairies, but if you apply for and get accepted, you can do other types of rural development as well. We applied through that same office under the direction of the Board of Regents, and we picked up permission to do other types of facilities. Here's what we did. We did dozens of dairies, two of which I believe actually went bankrupt, but they were bought out of bankruptcy. They're in operation today. We did the Dakota Provisions, which is the turkey processing plant in Huron. people don't realize it, but we produce somewhere around 5 million turkeys in South Dakota a year. They process them there. A lot of the deli meats that you get in your local stores, the chances are really good it came from Dakota Provisions. But that's an EB5 project. Deadwood Mountain Grand in the Black Hills of South Dakota is an EB5 project. The REAs, the EPA shut down their request for a coal-fired power plant up by Selby. So they went to two natural gas-fired power plants. Those were both financed through EB5 investments. And the one that everybody talks about, which is Northern Beef in Aberdeen, was an EB5 a project. They borrowed money from EB5 investors, and $55 million, as a matter of fact. They actually started an operation, put over $120-some million into the facility itself during the time of a national recession. So for me, yeah, we used it as a tool. We did our best to get those out and to work them, but we had something bad happen as well. And this is the part that I think folks have focused on. And as we said, we've been very disappointed as well. In the last couple of weeks of my administration, one of my trusted members of my cabinet, Rich Benda, who was a friend, I've known him since 1980, trusted, come highly recommended by other economic development officials throughout South Dakota. He modified a document that I had issued giving a $1 million future fund grant to the folks at Northern Beef because they were getting ready to operate and they qualified according to the conditions that we'd laid out for them. I gave him a year to put together construction receipts, and we'd reimburse him for $1 million in their construction receipts. When it got to them, it had been modified. Rich had modified it. I saw the letter in September of last year, in which he changed it from a year to 90 days. And I couldn't understand why. The attorney general asked me to come on in and take a look at it last year and said, is this the document that you guys sent? And I said, no, it's not. I said, mine did not have that change on it. I gave him a year. He says, were you aware of the change? I said, no, I wasn't. So I was. Why would Rich make that modification? He clearly initialed it. But it turns out that Rich had also, at that time, he told us he was going to go to work for one of the investors in the beef plant, which we thought was a positive thing because we knew he believed in it, and we wanted to see the beef plant move forward. We thought that was a positive thing, and he had advised us that since he was not being retained under the new administration, that's what he was going to do. What Rich did was he also made a note on the thing that said to the Department of Tourism Economic Development, when they give you the receipts, I'd love the opportunity to deliver the check. So when they sent their receipts into the state, the auditors looked at it. It was all legit. The piece of paper was legit. The letter was legit. Everything matched. They issued the check for $1 million to Northern Beef. And the guys in Pierce said, hey, there's a note on here saying Rich would like to deliver the check. Called him. He came in, picked up the check, and took it up to Northern Beef. But when he got there with the check, he is alleged to have said to them, look, I've got your check for $1 million, but, you know, I'm also working for the company that got the $55 million in loans for you, and we're due the loan monitoring fee of $550,000. I think they thought they had the life of the loan to pay it off. He requested that they pay it in advance. That's what's alleged. The attorney general was going to visit with Richard on that the week following the time of his suicide. He's disappointed us. Once again, these are allegations that were made with Richard. Nonetheless, he took his own life. He's left a daughter here in South Dakota. He's about 17. A real tragedy. Would we like to ask Rich some questions? Yes. But nonetheless, the attorney general was going to make contact with him because of the inappropriate, and the attorney general's concern was the inappropriate thing of holding a check saying, pay us in advance the dollars which you do owe the company that I'm working for now. They had cut the check. They gave it to Rich. He deposited it in his company's account. And I found out about that in September of 2013. So it's there. It's out there. But the EB-5 process itself has been good for South Dakota. Do we wish that we wouldn't have had any issues with Richard? The attorney general says it's an isolated issue. There was no other state employee involved. I was never the object of any investigation. There's been 8 different departments that have looked at this. No one is seeing a conspiracy. It's been identified as one person who has allegedly made a very serious mistake.
Well, Mike Rounds, we're out of time, but I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us on Dakota Midday.
Thank you very much.